Greetings from the great state of Missouri. I was impressed with the things that time proves. I remember reading the prophecies concerning Cyrus. Did you realize that God, through Isaiah, named Cyrus before he was born? Before he was born. So, I mention that because leading into this topic, I think my topic is probably as much different from the one that preceded this as anything, but the value of what we have to do with is important to this topic of do we expect too much? People seem to rebel at demands that are made upon them and resent things that take their time and their effort away from things that they want to do, pursuits that they want to pursue. Even refusing many times to give in and allow themselves to become real Christians and live a Christian life. People say, well, I think they do ask too much over there. They just too much, or they say something that's akin to that. I just can't live up to these expectations. That really is the proverbial cop-out. That usually is by a person who doesn't have the desire to live up to it. I realize that none of us are ever going to be sinless, perfect Christians. That person doesn't exist. That is upon this earth. But nevertheless, we're expected to do certain things, and God's expectations are reasonable. I have to have my own time. I have to be able to do my own thing. I don't know why I can't go on with my own life and live it the way I want to. Years ago, I was called upon occasionally to work on Sunday evenings. In fact, I worked a lot of Sunday evenings. I always get up and went to services in the morning, but Sunday evening I went in one time and there was a conversation going on among the men, and one of the men was using some language that I objected to. And he said, "Listen here, Mel Short," said, "I went to church this morning, but now I'm down here at work, and this ain't church." Well, he wasn't telling me anything I didn't know, but this ain't church. But he was a good church member. He went that morning, but this ain't church. It taught me something about him, that he had a double standard. He wouldn't talk that way when he was at church, I'm sure. But the minute he left the doors of the building, his life changed. Are we expecting too much? I'd like to talk about this a little while this afternoon, about Christianity and these double standards. And I thought perhaps you would handle the subject differently from, I'm sure you would, from what I do, and so I'll just handle it my own way. Asking ourselves questions: is Christianity just merely an hour's entertainment on Lord's Day? Now, I know that a lot of people go to church to be entertained. And the better the entertainment, the better people like it. But that should not be the primary reason for going to church. It's not just like going into a doctor's office and getting a shot or an injection, and then that'll take care of things. You can go out and do whatever you want to do the rest of the week. It's not like a good luck charm. I remember seeing a television program one time, The Exorcist, in which a person took a metal cross and used that to shake around in front of someone who was possessed with a demon, supposedly. And of course, we know that doesn't happen. But if it did happen, that metal cross would have absolutely no effect. It wouldn't do any good anyway, because a little metal cross isn't going to stop a demon. It takes something more than that. reminded of the Apostle Peter on one occasion. And I try not to come down too hard on the Apostle Peter because he was a pretty good man and he gave his life for the Lord. But in the second chapter of the Galatian letter, we find that he was guilty of acting one way one time and another way another time. And the Apostle Paul, headquartering in Antioch, later wrote about Peter's trip to Antioch. And in Galatians 2:11, when Peter came to Antioch, I withstood him to the face because he was to be blamed. For before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. So Peter was he was willing to eat the Gentiles. He would associate with them, all right. But the minute the brethren came down from Jerusalem, he didn't have anything more to do with Gentiles. So he was acting differently under different circumstances. And going down just a little ways, Paul said, when I saw that they walked not uprightly, that is Peter and those who were with him, they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel. Then he went ahead and talked to the Apostle Peter about that. And I'm sure that Paul and Peter were friends and brothers from that time on, as they had been before. But a double way of thinking about things. We have a profession. I'd like to talk about our profession, our calling, just briefly. I'd like to talk about stale religion, about rusty swords, and about altars to sin. Altars to sin. We have a profession. The Apostle Paul wrote to that young evangelist Timothy, who had started out with the Apostle and learned, I'm sure, a great deal about serving the Lord from the Apostle Paul. And Paul wrote back to him later, and he said, that great profession, that you have professed a good profession. Well, a profession, when we think of the word profession, we think of somebody like a doctor or a lawyer. Basically, of course, Webster says that it's a principal calling, a vocation, or employment. This is the primary work in a person's life when you talk about their profession. Paul, if he wrote the Hebrew letter in 3:1, says Jesus is the high priest of our profession. So our profession is one that requires us to put our efforts into it, our life into it. In 4:14 and 10:23, Paul says, hold fast your profession. It's a profession that we need to cling to. The word calling is used many times in the scriptures, and it's quite similar to the word profession, the calling of a person. This is what occupies this person. This is what identifies this person. We speak of a doctor. We call him Doctor so-and-so, and we know immediately what we're talking about. He's identified for us. Well, this is our calling, our profession. In 1:26, Paul says, you see your calling. There he said, how that not many mighty, not many noble are called. And if you go to church where the prestigious people are, you may be missing the mark. Because Paul said, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But it is your calling. In 3:14, he speaks of the prize of reaching for the prize of your high calling. The high calling. In 2:1:9, he calls it a holy calling. In 2 Peter 1:10, Peter says, be diligent to make your calling and election sure. And that word diligent, just think about it for a second. That word diligent is not something that allows for service for an hour on Lord's Day morning and then just forget about it. Diligent means to work hard, to make it the center of our thought and effort, and really put out some work. Diligent. Ephesians 4 and 4, there's one hope of your calling. There's a future in this calling. There is a future. People don't like to go into a profession where there's no future, but this is the greatest future of all. It has promised not only in this world, but of that which is to come. 2 Thessalonians 1:11, Paul says that he prayed they would be worthy of this calling. So it's a calling also that demands an effort that we be worthy of it. We certainly don't want people to say, well, he's certainly no credit to that profession. Hebrews 3 and 1, he calls it a heavenly calling of which we are partakers. And in Romans 1 and 7, he says something that shocks a lot of people, that we are called to be saints. I've heard a lot of people say, well, I'm no saint. Well, they've got a modern definition of that word saint. They may be telling the truth. They're no saint, all right. But the word saint in the Bible is synonymous with Christian. A church member who is trying to live a Christian life is a saint. And all it means is that you are dedicated to God. That's what it means to be called. And every member of the Lord's body is a saint. Not just some person that is elevated and made famous by somebody overseas at church headquarters. Every member of the body of Christ is called to be saints. So we have a profession, we have a calling. Today, it seems to me that the mindset of people is a good deal like it was way back in the days of Isaiah. In Isaiah 29:13, wherefore the Lord saith, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder, for the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. A warning from Isaiah that this people can't go on this way, honoring me with their lips, but not loving me in their heart. Jesus quoted this in his own time and applied it to the generation alive when he was upon earth. That generation was doing the same thing. Your heart must be in it in order for God to be acceptable, or for God to be willing to accept it. We mentioned stale religion. People say, well, you know, a lot of that stuff is, that was all right 2,000 years ago. But not now. We've got to be modern. Well, in effect, they're telling the Almighty Creator that you don't know what you're talking about. You wrote some stuff back there, but you're not up to date anymore, God. You're just out of date. Imagine telling your Maker that. And that's what a lot of people are doing. Stale religion. Stale religion gets that way, not because it's old, but because it isn't used or it's misused. In the book of Revelation, the 3rd chapter and the 16th verse, he wrote to the Laodiceans, and he said, I would that you were cold or hot, but you're lukewarm. And because you're lukewarm, I will spew you out of my mouth. Isn't that a terrible picture? But it illustrates to us exactly what Jesus Christ thinks of people who have no more thought about his word than that. They're just lukewarm about it. I will spew you out of my mouth. Paul pleaded with the Roman brethren, Romans 12 and 11, to be fervent in spirit. Now this fervent in spirit refers to the mindset of people who come to the Lord, who are Christians, and it's a necessity if we're going to be diligent in making our and going about our profession. Rusty swords. You know, the experience of Desert Storm The reserve troops and National Guard troops were called up in this country, and while it wasn't publicized a whole lot, yet the military men who lead this country were shocked because so many of the units were unfit to go into battle. They were not battle ready. The problem was in their training. They weren't ready for modern warfare, and some of them had to be shunted aside. Of course, the men and women who did go over there, we are certainly grateful that they were trained as well as they were, and they did a good job. But in the background is that untrained group, not ready. Their weapons were not sharp and bright, and neither were their own minds and actions. One of the things a soldier does, the foot soldier, if he doesn't have anything else to do at the moment, if he's just sitting there waiting for the next meal or whatever, clean the rifle. Well, I cleaned it yesterday. Clean the rifle. You keep cleaning it, and you keep it oiled, and it's bright. You know, it might look rather senseless to do that all the time, but if your life depends on that weapon, you can't start polishing it when you're facing an enemy. It has to be ready to go. A weapon that's hanging over the fireplace may be a pretty thing, but you go up to it, and you may find that it's covered with dust, and you may find that it's pitted. Now, I wonder how many spiritual swords are hanging there for the world to see, all right, but they've just hung over the fireplace. We mentioned altars to sin. In the book of Hosea, Hosea said, because Ephraim hath made many altars to sin, altars shall be unto him to sin. Now, of course, the main thrust of this had to do with those people who were still worshiping God, but they were going and worshiping idols too. And if I understand what Hosea is saying here, that the altar that he made to that God is an altar to sin, but his altar to God is going to be sin too, because he's trying to mix both of them. He's trying to worship the gods of the people around him and the God of heaven all at the same time. I have written to him the great things of my law, but they were counted as a strange thing. Yes, people speak of Christians and say how they're just so queer and just so weird about these things. But he goes on and says some more things. They sacrifice flesh for the sacrifices of mine offerings and eat it, but the Lord accepteth them not. The Lord won't even accept their sacrifices. Now will he remember their iniquity and visit their sins. They shall return to Egypt. They're going to be back in bondage again. Altars to sin. In the book of Proverbs, the 21st chapter and verse 3, to do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. The way you live when you're not in the church building is going to run in judgment right along with your service when you are in the church building. And what the writer of the book of Proverbs was saying is it's more acceptable to God for you to live a Christian life. That is the point. That is the point. Impressive services, ritual, beautiful ceremonies, they do not obviate living a Christian life or substitute for it. There's no substitution there. In the book of Samuel, we remember the time when Saul broke two of the commands of God. He went ahead and offered a sacrifice even though he wasn't a priest. And he had already disobeyed one of God's commands about keeping alive the cattle of the Amalekites. When Samuel came, the great prophet of God came there, he criticized Saul. In fact, told him his kingdom was going to be taken from him. But he said, "Hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams." People get to the place where God will not accept even their worship of Him anymore. He told the Israelites through Isaiah again, he was warning them that if you don't straighten this out, I'm going to have to move against this people. And he told them that your sacrifices, the very sacrifices and the worship of God that God Himself had told them to do, said, "I cannot away with. I can't stomach your worship any longer." And I wonder how, if God would say that to people like the man that I mentioned who said, "This ain't church." I wonder if his worship at church services affected God like that of ancient Israel. Jeremiah 6 and 20. "Your burnt offerings are not acceptable unto me. Your sacrifices are not sweet unto me." In the book of Malachi, Malachi asks a really modern question. Malachi 3:13, "Your words have been stout against me, saith the Lord, yet you say, what have we spoken so much against thee?" Now these people were worshiping God, but God is saying, "You're speaking against me. You have said, it is vain to serve God. And what profit is it that we have kept His ordinance, and that we have walked mournfully before the Lord of hosts?" A lot of people ask questions quite similar to that today. What good does it do to do all those things? What good does it do to serve God? Proverbs 28:9, he spoke of those who rebel against the commands of God and said, "Even his prayer shall be abomination." There are people praying to God today whose prayers affect God that way. Even his prayer should be abomination. A lot of people are asleep at the switch today. I'm tempted to throw in the story of the 10 virgins on this that Jesus told. We remember that 10 of those people were waiting for the bridegroom to come. 5 are wise and 5 are foolish. The difference, of course, was in the preparation. 5 of them were making preparation. They were working at it, they were prepared for the Lord to come. The other 5, they were worried about it. They were just sort of lukewarm about that. When the bridegroom came, they weren't ready, and they weren't let in to the wedding ceremony. Jesus said, "Watch ye therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh." Words give us pictures. There's a picture comes to my mind when I read the first 2 verses of Hebrews 12. "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." Most of us, I suppose, saw the Olympic Games and thrilled at the exploits of those young athletes. But the ancient games, of course, were played in an arena, and the very picture that I'm sure the writer intended for us to get is that we are in the arena. We are running the race. All of us are athletes in these games. We're running the race. But in the stands, There are thousands of people watching what you do. But he said there's a great cloud of witnesses. Well, who are you talking about, Paul? Who's up there in the stands? Well, back in the fourth verse of the chapter before, he mentions Abel, going all the way back in history. By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than his brother Cain. In the fifth verse, he mentions Enoch, the man who was translated because he was righteous and God took him home to heaven with him. In the eighth verse, he mentions, or in the seventh verse, he mentions Noah, the great preacher of righteousness, who endured all the mockery of his generation and built an ark. But he saved his family and himself. In the eighth verse, Abraham. And I can just hear Abraham, if he were one of the moderns, and God said, Abraham, leave your home and go. And I'm not going to tell you now, but just go and I'll show you where. What's the youngsters would say, not. No, Lord, I can't do that. Abraham went, not knowing whither he went. The 11th verse, Sarah, a great lady of faith. The Bible has quite a few women mentioned in it who are examples for us to follow. Their son, Isaac, grandson Jacob, are mentioned. These are the people who are sitting in the stands. These are the witnesses he's talking about. How do they witness it? He's not telling us that they're sitting there looking at actually at what you're doing, but their life stands as a testimony, telling us, telling God, that men can live righteous lives in this world. They can be dedicated to the service of God. They can perform great things for the Lord with faith in Him. They are the ones who are sitting in the stands. We're performing. It's our turn now. But the champions of yesteryear are sitting in the seats and watching. Joseph and Moses. And he goes on down into the last part of that chapter. I wish we had time to go into all of that. In verse 38, he, after listing all of those people, he said, of whom the world was not worthy. The world was not worthy. But these weren't lukewarm people. These were people who gave their all. Other examples, of course, the early Christians from day to day. They met together daily and they rejoiced in serving the Lord. Paul and Silas were arrested and put into prison. They were put in stocks. They were locked into stocks so that hands and feet were tied. And of course, we all know what they were doing at midnight. They were singing praises to God. How many of us would be rejoicing in jail because we were Christians? I'm sure that some would, but that would certainly test our faith, wouldn't it? We're to be new creatures in Christ Jesus. We're to be living lights. Jesus said, you are the light of the world. The Christian is to let a light shine. And he explains that they seeing your good works may glorify God. That's the light that is to shine. And you can't let that light shine in that fashion if the only time you serve God is on Lord's Day morning. You've got to serve in the rest of the week too in order for that light to shine. And he said that by bad examples, let's see in 2 Peter 2 and 2, it's possible that the way of truth can be evil spoken of. If we allow ourselves to fall away into sin and error or follow false doctrines, then the way of truth will be evil spoken of. When we face the Lord, will we be able to say that, or will he say, you besmirched my name? People looked at you and thought you were a Christian and you brought shame to me. Peter said, "Be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you, with meekness and fear." And Jesus said, "Let your light so shine that they may see your good works." Not see that, hey, he's a good old boy. He's no do-gooder. He's just one of the gang. Well, that's pretty dangerous if people can say that about you, that you're just one of the gang. It means they're not making the right kind of difference between you and them. We're sentries of the Lord. Here again, we could spend a lot of time reading the scriptures that say such things as the song says, "When Jesus comes, will he find us watching? Watch you therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour." I wonder how that man would have felt if the Lord had come about the time he was telling me this ain't church. And those who absent themselves from services of the church, hoping, I suppose, that the Lord will come in that hour on Lord's Day morning when they're at services. What if he didn't come then? What if he came Tuesday evening? Or Wednesday evening? Or any time? He's probably not going to come Lord's Day morning at 10:30. I think probably we need to think of the greatness of what we have and the value of the reward. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4 and 17, "Our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." Paul was, he was trying to keep the record straight and keep things in proper perspective. When he used the term light affliction, it wasn't light affliction by a lot of the standards we would use. The list of things Paul endured and the sufferings that he had, the work that he had to do, is a long list. Terrible things were done to the Apostle Paul. He was stoned and left for dead on one occasion. I'm sure he would have died, but for the Lord's reviving him at that moment. But he called it a light affliction. The reason he called it a light affliction was not that it didn't hurt to be stoned, not that it didn't hurt to be whipped or to be put in jail, but because he knew that this was just a brief thing. Over there, he was looking forward to eternity. This was upon this earth a temporary that is eternal. When we think of the value of this, I was thinking of the song, My Father is Rich in Houses and Lands. I suppose growing up, we've all wished that our parents were really wealthy. They could have a big house and a big limousine and all the good things that we could enjoy. Well, friends, we have a father who is rich in houses and lands. And in the words of that song, he holdeth the wealth of the world in his hands. But he's called us to a profession, a holy calling, a high calling, a heavenly calling, and one with a great future if we'll just live with it. Another song comes to mind. "Must I be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease, while others fought to win the prize and sailed through bloody seas?" We've got our own battle to fight. Today, as we bring this lesson to a close, we don't know the hearts of everyone here present today, but there may be some who have never relinquished the direction of their souls to Christ Jesus, have never made his acquaintance. "Come unto me, learn of me, take my yoke upon you." I am meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest to your souls. If you want true rest, true peace, and a direction for your life, here is where you can find it. Jesus Christ. Relinquish that direction to Him, and He'll show you the way. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Some say, well, you're asking me to put a yoke upon me. Well, the purpose of a yoke, my friend, is to make it possible to pull the load. So the yoke is placed upon the shoulders of the worker so that the work can be done. But there's another comforting thing. In this, it's a double yoke. And you know who's in the other half of the yoke? The Lord Himself. You take a yoke upon you, and He's there at your side. So today, we're asking you to think seriously about this. Take advantage of the opportunity. Begin this high calling and profession with the great future, the best future of any profession in the world. If you would come today and confess your faith in Him, repenting of your sins and be baptized in His name, put that yoke on and learn about the Lord. Or if you've done that and fallen away, or whatever your needs, won't you come while we stand and sing?